Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some nuggets of gold that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature. Although sometimes that might feel counterintuitive, just like a bird, the nightingale, singing out in the dark. I'm JJ, also known as the Practical Alchemist, and I'm delighted that you could join me today. Thank you so much. My guest today was last on this show a year ago. Time really does fly, to talk about the Food for the Brain Charitable Foundation, which he founded to help us all minimise our risk of dementia. I'm talking about Patrick Holford, of course, who also founded the Institute for Optimum Nutrition here in the UK. He's been a leading spokesman on nutrition and mental health for many years and is a prolific author. His latest book is out now and it's called Upgrade Your Brain. And you could say it's the companion to the excellent cognitive function test you'll find at foodforthebrain.org. More on that to come. First, there's a general deterioration in brain health. So I started our chat by asking Patrick what is causing this.
Well, I think it absolutely has to be diet, since our brain is built from diet. And I would put my money on three things. Definitely the nutrients that are found in fish, because fish and seafood is very, very low. I mean, children are eating less of it. And when we test omega-3 levels in kids and adults, they're very low. So I think we've moved away from a marine food diet that was even prevalent, during World War. I mean, seafood was never, ever, ever rationed. So I think it's that lack of omegas. There's B vitamins in seafood as well. I think we're lacking B vitamins because insidiously, we just do have more refined foods. And I think it would be a real shocker if we live in the illusion that if we eat this whole food or that carrot or this tomato, we get a certain amount of nutrients. But, there is no commercial imperative to grow tomatoes or carrots to have vitamin A or whatever. And I think if we actually analyzed the foods that we're eating, we'd find the nutrient content is low. Yeah. Then there's the whole sugar and what today, sexily is called ultra processed food. But, I remember back in the 70s and 80s, we said eat food you can pull out of a tree or out of the ground. Eat whole foods. Do not eat white foods. Do not eat refined foods. So this is just a kind of, reiteration of that. I remember the day when we finally got the classification of all additives as E numbers. So that's kind of part of ultra-processed food. So I think that's a very big deal. And, only 2 days ago is a big report saying even though we might be living a little bit longer, we're much sicker. We've got more diabetes, more heart disease, more obesity, and so on. We know these are driven by food. So I would say, if I put my money on it, say sugar, omega-3s, B vitamins, hard-hitting changes that are driving the mental health devolution, backed up with, digital tech and, the way we end up so stressed.
Yeah. And of course, you talk about all of that in your new book, Upgrade Your Brain, which is a brilliant distillation, I think, of all the things that we should do. But, all these things like B vitamins, oily food, I've actually started eating more. I've always eaten a lot of fish, but I've started eating more oily food, even if that means a tin of sardines rather than having a fillet of cod or halibut. I live by the sea. It's everywhere. I have fishmongers all around me where I live. So fish is very good, but I do deliberately choose some oilier fish now as well, which I didn't do before. But
we say smash it, salmon, mackerel, anchovies, sardines, herrings, kippers, thinking that.
Yeah. All of that. Yeah. Well, kippers and herrings. Yeah, very much so. But herrings only in season. But none of this is mentioned in this study in The Lancet. What's going on there?
But yes, it's quite shocking, really, verging on fraud. But basically, there's a whole group of experts who produced the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention. First edition was 2017, second edition 2020, and the third edition came out just a few weeks ago. And the point, the context of it is what can people do to prevent dementia? And it all looks very positive, and there were lots of articles in the newspapers about how 40% of dementia is preventable if you don't smoke, don't live in a, have air pollution. Cataracts was a new addition to the list. You know, if you have cataracts and you have surgery, you reduce your risk by 2%. So, you know, it accounts for a certain degree of risk. But the shocker here is that, and it, you know, it's one of those big hefty reports that says we have a very high bar of our scientific conclusion. And the essence, you know, for science is you take a number of studies, ideally, perhaps, randomized controlled trials, you know, B vitamins versus placebo. You average the results, and then you can say, taking B vitamins. I mean, there's two parts to this, by the way. One is how many people are low in B vitamins or omegas, and if you correct it, what's the advantage? So if you step back objectively and look at the science, the single most evidenced thing for preventing dementia is lowering homocysteine, which is a measure in the blood that relates to, and then giving B vitamins. And all the major reviews, like in China, say it's the number one thing. In America, a major meta-analysis of all studies said it accounts for 22% of risks, so not 2% of cataracts, but 22%. And it was ignored in 2017. So we sent the author, Professor Jill Livingston, all the papers, ignored in 2022, having sent 2020, having sent all the papers. So knowing that this, or sniffing that this one was coming along, we sent the papers well more than once and got acknowledgement. So we know that they were received, and not a single mention. I mean, just absolutely nothing mentioned. And, you know, we have, you know, major professors from China to America to the UK. I mean, there's not, you know, left field players. There's sort of Vice Dean of Oxford Medical School, you know, that sort of level of people. So that's quite shocking. So a group of our scientists wrote to The Lancet about B vitamins. Then omegas, which again is really, really big. And the important point here is sort of interesting is that when you look at air pollution and smoking, there's, you know, for good reason, not a single controlled trial, you know, people who haven't. So it's just what we call an observation, that people who have more air pollution, you know, have more dementia. Now, how the hell do you change that? I mean, this is a report about what people can do to change it. And of course you say, oh, okay, I'm, you know, leaving the city, but, you know, it's fairly drastic. And obviously something like smoking, there's no randomized controlled trial. Then you come onto a section which is headed insufficient evidence. And they quote one study on omega-3, very good study. And it says the omega-3 was associated with reduced brain shrinkage, which is what you want. I mean, that's the real measure. Reduced rate of brain shrinkage and, you know, and cognitive improvements. So that the two things that you measure are brain shrinkage, cognitive. So perfect. And I think the reason that they excluded it was that they just mentioned one study. Now, if you happen to have read the newspapers in the last year, you would have seen there's actually 12 studies now, major studies from UK Biobank. I mean, these have all been reported. And in our world, we go into a library of science called PubMed, and you put an omega-3 dementia, up pops everything. So they could easily have got not one study, but 12, and done the meta-analysis. And they would have found, as they did in the National Institute of Health, that seafood intake and omega-3 accounted for 22% of risk. So here you have two risk factors, which already are, you know, by far the biggest, completely excluded. And then the third was effectively diet. You know, they said there is not enough evidence in relation to diet, although obviously you should eat more fruit and veg and whatever. And that's a little bit messier because you don't have one thing to measure. You see, with omega-3, we can literally measure it in the blood. You could give omega-3 supplements or placebo. So no excuse for that at all. The sugar, a little bit of an excuse. But anyway, our omega-3 experts wrote to The Lancet, our sugar experts wrote to The Lancet, because now we have an underlying mechanism by which we understand how our modern-day highly sugared diet is driving things. So, you know, they get to 45% prevention. If you added in those three, you might get to 80 or 90% prevention. And the point is, how easy is it to increase your omega-3? You've just told me you've done it. How easy is it to increase your B vitamins, and, you know, how easy is it to reduce your sugar? Admittedly, it's a bit addictive, but, you know, it rather than, you know, air pollution or something. Yeah. So These are world experts that are influencing, definitely National Health Service and so on. And they sort of provide the excuse. And actually, we've had a number of our experts have gone and met with Professor Jill Livingston, who actually was a co-author of a paper on our test, saying how brilliant it was. And she says, nobody has raised homocysteine, which is the B vitamin thing. Well, actually, it's about half of everyone over 65. And there aren't any studies showing B vitamins work. Well, that's kind of weird because she's been sent them. And we've spoken to a few members of the group saying, was this research shared with you? So, once, okay, twice, this is not good. Three times, now with 10 years of evidence, I mean, this is we call it bad science. And I can't say why they've excluded it, but I do know that if B vitamins and omega-3 were taken seriously, we wouldn't be talking about all these anti-amyloid drugs because they seriously outperform them. So it could be, that those easy to take supplements, inexpensive, might cost you £100 a year. Could be, I'm not saying it is, a major threat to pharma.
Well, I was just going to ask you if you felt that was what this was all about.
I think sort of ultimately it is, because also in the UK particularly, but not, a lot of medical systems, there's this deep suspicion about supplements.
Yeah, there is.
It really annoys me. I mean, I read the Times the other day and there's, Professor Tim Spector, of Zoe, who does some interesting work. But he said supplements, waste of time. There's no evidence that vitamin C prevents colds. And the thing is, and this is a sort of funny one, he'll quote a good friend of mine, brilliant professor of public health and medicine in Helsinki, Professor Harry Hemela. And he did the, the most extensive meta-analysis Cochrane review. And it's true, if you put all studies ever done on vitamin C together, you don't get a statistically different number of colds, but you get shorter colds and you get less severe colds, right? And I remember, not so long ago doing a film, being invited as an expert on a film with the BBC. And they said, could you say that vitamin C does not cause, they're not less colds than people taking vitamin C? And I said, yeah, I'll say that, but the colds are shorter and the symptoms there. They said, could you leave out those two bits? I mean, this is close to fraud as well in a way, really. And of course, if you read Professor Harry Hemela's Cochrane Review or meta-analysis, or if you are actually even interested, and there's one guy who's just done the best research on everything, you'd look at his latest paper, which is easy to find. And of course, what you find is in studies that gave 4 to 8 grams, and there's one study where I think half of people had no symptoms at the end of 24 hours. So then you're down to sort of semantics. In other words, if I take vitamin C when I get a cold in high dose, and I take about a gram an hour, and by the end of the day, I have no cold, then you'd say, well, that's not prevention, right? Because that's not just like taking it every day and not getting a cold. So, well, we're into semantics. It's a bit like, if you knew that taking vitamin C in a day stops the cold, you'd probably say it's a cure for colds. You might use
that. Yeah, you would. Yeah.
And my wife's a lovely example, because one of our grandkids came up and they were sniffly and snotty and had a sore throat. And they don't like, they're young and they don't, and fussy, and they don't like taking pills and they don't like the taste of the vitamin C. So they suffered. So my wife got it. And, she superdosed with vitamin C. It's gone. And I didn't, because I knew. So I sort of up the dose, I felt it tickling slightly in the background, but it sort of doesn't really bite. So, it's just boring, really. But also misleading. And we have that sort of culture of not really, looking properly at the evidence on supplements. And there's something else that's important to say, because when you do a randomized placebo-controlled trial on a drug, half of the group are 100% on the drug dose, and the other half of the group are 100% on zero drug. But when you, for example, give everybody a gram of vitamin C, or half a gram and half placebo, the placebo group don't have no vitamin C. They're eating things. So you don't know. Some of them may be perfectly good on vitamin C and others might be lower. So that's really the point. And that's why doing studies where you measure the omega-3 index, so you know that, I mean, I don't believe that B vitamins prevent Alzheimer's, but B vitamins given to people with a raised homocysteine, which happens to be about half of everyone over 65, that absolutely does. So when you then look at colds, just as an example, really, for things, you find that, there's an effect in children, there's an effect in studies where people were stressed. There were effects in studies where people were cold, because they actually did studies in the army, in the military, in Switzerland, and so on. So under conditions of being cold, being stressed, and they didn't really look at who had higher or lower levels. So, this is just the nature of nutrients. You can never have a pure placebo-controlled trial because you don't know what's, whether someone's eating fish or not eating fish or doing this or doing that. So yeah, there is this culture of a knee-jerk reaction, and it's terrible to see. I mean, I had this with Chris Van Tulkin as well, who's written the very good book on ultra-processed foods, and again on vitamin C, and it really annoyed me because what he did was he took 1 or 2 grams of vitamin C, and then collected all of his urine over the next 24 or 48 hours, and he excreted almost, what he'd taken in. And therefore, he said, waste of time. And of course, if he'd drunk, 1 or 2 liters of water and collected all his urine, he would have excreted almost all the water he drank, So you go, you don't need water. And what actually happens is that vitamin C exists in two forms: the fully loaded form, which is called ascorbic acid, which is what you get in a supplement, orange. And then the spent vitamin C, which is called dihydroascorbic acid. So if you were going to do this experiment, you'd want to know, you've taken 1,000 milligrams of ascorbic acid, then you collect the urine, and you want to know how much of the vitamin C in the urine is spent, which means it's actually done work. It's become oxidized. So you can say, oh, that's interesting. I actually used half of everything that I took in. And that's really basic chemistry. And it sort of miffs me that somebody, both of these guys, for example, claim to be really hard on the science. We are the scientists, we are there. And they're making some fundamental mistakes in reading papers or understanding, really basic chemistry. And thus people are misled.
Wow. And of course, Patrick is hard on the science too, but it's time for us to take a short break right now. I'll be back with more from nutrition and brain health expert Patrick Holford right after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ Stenhouse, the practical alchemist, and my guest today, Patrick Holford. Now, before the break, Patrick was talking about a culture of being resistant to taking supplements here in the UK. Now, I've noticed this too, and it fascinates me. Here's how we continued.
What I see is that people are so used to just handing over the power of their health, the power to be well, to their doctor, that they don't even think about taking something like vitamin C or a B vitamin. We're so conditioned to just running along to the doctor's surgery, some of us, not all of us, that we don't even think about supplements. And supplements are a bit sort of, oh, I don't know. The doctor hasn't told me I should take that. I mean, what do you think? I mean, that's what I see.
I think it's true. And funny enough, I think you knew from our little chat before building a chicken coop.
Yes.
Anyway, I happened to be in town in Abergavenny in Wales buying a light fitting or something I needed to fix. And the man said to me, what did you do in your career? I mean, looking at me, I'm 66, thinking I'm retired. And I said, well, I actually haven't stopped yet. And I explained a bit about, what we do at Dimension and all the rest of it. And he said, I think if you go to see a doctor and they don't mention your diet and lifestyle, they're a drug dealer.
Wow.
That's my view. And, that's kind of, you know, where it's at. And it the is. Other day, I was actually thinking in my lifetime in nutrition and health and science, which is sort of 45 or so years, maybe a bit longer, what have I actually seen that's been, you know, done on prevention in a reasonably effective way? And I thought, smoking.
Yeah.
Really smoking. I mean, we're drinking tons of alcohol. Smoking is, by the way, now being overtaken, you know, by vaping. So that's kind of coming back. Sugar, we've failed, you know, to reduce, really. You know, and the reason that came out was the Institute for Optimum Nutrition, which I founded 40 years ago. We just had its birthday. Somebody said, you know, now that our Labour Prime Minister was appointed a professor of prevention, Professor John Deanfield. So there are three things we have to do to transform the National Health Service. One is to digitize health, which is really what we're doing in foodforthebrain.org. And the other is prevention. So I decided to Google every single thing he'd written and read everything I could and put in the word search engine, diet, nutrition, not a single mention.
Not a word. No.
And then I found an article he's got shares in and is paid by Novo Nordisk, who are the makers of, you know, of Ozempic and, you know, those GLP-1 agonists. And I realized that's what he's published on. He's a cardiologist. So the idea is if we can give more people more drugs sooner, that's what we call prevention.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
But I think there are two points, because obviously with this deeply ingrained sort of anti-supplement culture, there are two really important points to make for people who think, and I understand this because I grow all my own food. I can get it all from food. If I get the right food, I don't need the nutrients and so on. But the first is that our ancestors were expending three times the calories that we do. They had to walk, they had to chop wood, they had to fetch water, you know. So for 99% of our history, I mean, the average man in Crete, I discovered 200 years ago, was walking 7 miles a day.
Yeah.
So if you double or triple your calorie expenditure, you're going to double or triple your food. So in other words, you've got two or three times the food, all of which was organic, all of which was whole, because refined food didn't exist. There weren't fridges, obviously weren't, you know, delivery systems and so on. So now you've crunched, you know, that three times food down to one times food, and you've got to get all the zinc and all the magnesium and all the vitamin C from much, much less. So in other words, we sometimes have to supplement just to get to the level that our ancestors got for 99%
of food. Exactly. I totally get that. Yeah. And look at what's being sold in the shops as food. Some of it has very little nutritional value.
And the shocker there is, I mean, if I go into a service station, you look around, I mean, everything in here, we used to say good food goes off and the trick is to eat it first. You know, there's nothing that goes off. I mean, dead.
Exactly.
But at the other end, my good friend Dan Kittredge, who runs the Bionutrient Research Institute, he's analyzed organic, biodynamic, zero dig, regenerative, bought in a farm, bought in a supermarket, etc. And in all of those categories, he can find a 40-fold variation in the nutrient level of a carrot.
Yeah.
So it's a shocker. So even, you know, when I buy organic in the supermarket or whatever, which I do, and I totally believe in buying organic so you don't have all the pesticides, and I support the movement entirely.
Me too.
It's still not a guarantee that that carrot's, you know, going to deliver the goods. So one of the things we're doing down in Wales is, you know, we're sort of measuring things and we're going to use, you know, all these methods. But the thing that kind of rammed it home, I said, what have you found that does predict nutrient density? And he said, the only thing so far we've found that actually predicts nutrient density is a measure of the respiration of the soil. If the soil has a really good microbiome, you know, organisms, they are breathing.
Mm.
You can measure that respiration, the life of the soil, and it's that that predicts the nutrient density. Now, you couldn't have that healthy microbiome if you didn't have the right minerals in the soil, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it, you know, it all comes back to nutrition and
it
things
does.
Like fish. I mean, we just used to eat a lot more. We know the evolution of the human brain depended on us being a waterside ape, moving along estuaries, wading in water, et cetera, et cetera. So it was only really our brain size started to shrink about 20 or so thousand years ago. It peaked at 1,700 grams, and then about 20, 30,000 years ago, it's now down to 1,330 grams. So we've lost 20% of brain size in the last 20 or so thousand years, which coincides with moving to agriculture.
Interesting.
Away from the water's edge and marine foods, plant foods, and into agriculture.
Yeah.
For, you know, good reasons, and humanity could expand and all sorts of things happen. But it is these change in what we put in our mouth that quickly changes, you know, our brains. So that's why I say it's, you know, a major driver is what we're eating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very lucky around here in Fife. There are many farms, small holdings, orchards, where they practice the best possible soil husbandry, because they understand that it starts with the soil. No, you've got to have a healthy soil to grow healthy food. And talking about carrots, there's a farm not far from me here with a farm shop. I would buy their carrots over anybody else's, even the organic carrots in the supermarket, because they've just probably just come out of the ground like not that long ago, maybe that day, you know? And so they're fresh, and I know that they haven't got any nasties on them, and they've been grown in soil that's healthy.
So
that is really important. Not entirely possible for everybody, though. If you live in the middle of London, you're going to, you know, maybe have a bit of an issue, unless you grow your own in your garden, if you're lucky to have one. But I want to get back to your book and the upgrading of our brains. What can we do then? Just some pointers, because you founded foodforthebrain.org, and you have on there a cognitive function test, which I took some time ago, and as a result have just improved some little things. I didn't do too badly in the test, but I've improved some things. So I make sure I have the B vitamins now, because I'm older than you, and I'm looking to, you know, improve my cognitive function. So I'm taking the B vitamins, making sure I've got enough. I increased the number of oily fish that I eat, because I've always eaten fish, a lot of fish, and I've always eaten organic food as much as possible. I don't like ultra processed food, as they call it now, and I keep sugar to a minimum. Sometimes I get a craving, though. Sometimes I just need something.
Well, we've kind of touched on the four biological drivers: the sugar thing, the B vitamin thing, and brain fats. And I just chucked in there vitamin D.
I'm doing that too.
As soon as your shadow is longer than your body, which is now in the UK, you're not making vitamin D. And then the fourth we've kind of touched on, which is these antioxidants and polyphenols in plants. Yeah. And so those are four. And what we've developed, I mean, and at foodforthebrain.org, you go there, you do the cognitive function test, which is not a questionnaire. It's quite challenging.
It is. It's a good test. Yeah.
Yeah. And it is a validated test, and it measures where your cognition is at. Some people say, I don't want to do it, I don't want to know. But you want to know, because after it, you do a questionnaire. The questionnaire works out your risk across eight domains. Those are four of them. And you get red, orange, yellow, or green. So you can see which is your weakest links. And what will help you the most. Now, also what we now have is a blood test, which measures your sugar resilience, which is called HbA1c. That's what they test to diagnose diabetes. And then omega-3 index, which is really, really good. Vitamin D, really, really good. Homocysteine, which is the measure for B vitamins. And then a new thing we've actually developed, which is quite brilliant, is glutathione index.
And that's great.
Glutathione is the most powerful antioxidant within our cells. Just like the story with vitamin C, it very quickly oxidizes. So it does its work and then gets spent. And all of this is on one kit, Pimprick, and you get to measure the fully loaded to oxidized ratio. And that's the glutathione index. So now you can say around that, I think I eat enough fruit and veg. I think it's good. I generally try organic and so on. You can actually find out exactly what's going on. And then we have healthy gut. Healthy gut is a little bit more nebulous. The research is sort of starting to come in, but we want some, you know, certainly fibrous foods, fermented foods and so on. So I'm sure in the years to come, we'll go a bit further. Dental health, we know, is very important. Gum disease, brushing, flossing, teeth, all of that reduces risk. Then we have active body, you know, which is exercise, active mind, you know, a good social life, a good intellectual life, learning new things, terribly important. And then the last category is called sleep and calm. So obviously it's easy to say, get enough sleep, don't be stressed. Easy to say, you know, but how do you do that? So our cognition program helps people, you know, to sort of drill down. And what we hope over the years is that we'll get better and better at guiding people to make behavior change. And we are in a digital age. And now we have 150 people every single day doing the test.
That's fantastic. That's really great.
We hope to end this year with having tested 500,000 people.
That is a huge number, and I'm glad to say that I'm one of them. I'll let you know how my retest went later. First, it's time for another short break. Stay tuned for more from Patrick Colford right after these messages.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. With me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest today, Patrick Holford. Now, I might be doing what I can to keep my brain healthy, but when it comes to timeframes, I can be a bit all over the place. For some reason, I had it in my head that the cognitive function test was a very new thing. Here's Patrick again.
No, we got the original cognitive function test started about 8 years ago.
Oh, was it? Oh, wow. See, but I was then what we late did to the party.
A bit, well, that was the actual test.
Yeah.
Then we started to research these risk factors. And then 2 years ago, we built this sort of behavior change program called Cognition that helps you to change their behavior. And And we are progressing. An incredible thing is with this tiny little charity, small, mighty. We now have a team of, you know, a year ago it was 4, now it's 12. We're funded by people who become friends of the charity and pay £50. We've actually got money in the bank. We're now building the same thing for kids.
Excellent.
And then what we've done or doing right now is we are going to launch in November in China. And then in Japan and in China, we expect to invite 18 million people to do the cognitive function test.
Oh, my God.
So it's all being translated into Chinese and Japanese. And it's what you start to realize, and I really want to say this to your viewers, listeners, is don't go, I don't want to do the test, you know, because I don't want to know. Just do it, foodforthebrain.org. Because when you do it, immediately, by the way, all your data, your diet, your lifestyle, your actual test, and if you have the blood test, even better, because we have biological data, it's all anonymized. So it becomes a number. You know, it's not your email, not, you know, nothing. You know, it's all completely GDPR approved and science and so on. But you've now become a citizen scientist. And we could very, very easily in the next couple of years get to the point where we have data on 1 million people, and we will invite you every 6 months to redo the test. I know you're about to redo the test.
I am.
And now, you know, this sort of thing that, you know, data is power, you know, it's all charitable as well. We're not like Zoe, which has, you know, been bought, their investors, you know, they'll want to sell the thing in 5 years for a big profit and all the rest of it. This is all totally 100% and always will be charitable. We now will very easily could have the largest database of information relating to cognitive decline in the world. And that means that any researcher anywhere who wants to study, I don't know, air pollution or smoking or omegas or this or that, whatever, you know, they want data. So they will come to, it's called the Cognition Biobank. And because we asked all the right questions and did all the right tests and so on, it sort of steers the thinking towards prevention. And rather than having to try and convert the National Health Service, which I don't think is going to happen by this professor of prevention, or you know, convert your doctor, which would be great because they are opinion leaders, all the purpose of all that is just to get to people. And we have the means just literally, you know, on the website, foodwithbrain.org, take the test to get to people.
Yeah.
So while everyone else is faffing around and, you know, being resistant to supplements and not trying to be politically incorrect in relation to the pharmaceutical agenda, we can just quietly be getting on. And today, you know, it's 150 people today who take the test, but, you know, maybe in January it's going to be 1,500 a day. You know, that's how we do this. And then this is really beautiful. The cognitive function test was designed, it's used in memory clinics to basically say, I think Fred's got a problem. Let's test him. Yes, he's not very good. So he's sort of in the amber zone, which we call mild cognitive impairment. Or, oh, no, he's in the red zone, which is dementia. But that green zone, you know, it's like, you know, did you do better than, you know, your partner or this or that?
Yeah,
or that?
Yeah.
It's just, oh, your score is slightly more green than mine. What we've now done, having done, you know, 400,000 people, is we know that the cognitive function test score decreases on average with every age from the age of 18. So, you know, it's dropping on average. By the age of 80, people are starting to have noticeable issues, and by 90, they're more serious. But what if you could, you know, what if you could have that line sort of go like that?
Straighten the curve.
It really does not take much. I mean, it's literally a 5% shift. And what you've got is people technically developing Alzheimer's when they're 200. In other words, they will not die with this terrible, terrible disease. You know, where your body is still functioning, but you can't even remember, you know, the name of your kids, which is normal.
It's awful. And we've talked about this before when we've talked about foodforthebrain.org. Both my parents had dementia and died with dementia. And it's something that I'm very aware of as a result and do not want to go down that road. So I'm, you know, taking on board, I was pretty much in the green. On the test, but there were things that I could improve.
Yeah.
And so I'm doing that because I do not want to go down that road. And, you know, I think I said to you before we started recording, I've been taking some lion's mane, which is really helping me as well, just be a little bit more focused. And, you know, I don't know long-term, reishi mushroom as well. So functional mushrooms can help, you know, beyond the B vitamins and beyond the dietary issues, then just taking little things like that. So I was smiling when you said you were going into China because, of course, they've known about these mushrooms for a long, long time. But I wonder how many Chinese people actually take them on a daily basis. And that's the thing.
I know. It'll be China is fascinating. I mean, you know, I know nothing. So it's fascinating to be working there. And but what I do know is their scientists are leading the way on homocysteine. So there's no resistance to that. A lot of the science papers are from China. They have very high levels of homocysteine in their population. They have not obviously a lot of numbers of people with dementia, particularly with the one child, you know, policy. So they've got a small workforce to support a very large older population.
Yeah.
But also their rate of dementia is exceptionally high.
And, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. No, I mean, if you sort of, per 100,000, in other words, forget them, they've got.
Yeah.
But per 100,000 is much higher. 40% of men smoke. Only something like 3% of women smoke. So there's a real culture of men smoking, women not smoking. And interestingly, the company that I'm working with, I said, you know, tell me about smoking. They said, no manager or director in our company can smoke. You know, it's just that way. We you know, we got 2,000 employees. If somebody smokes, we have a whole strategy to help them to quit. So we do, you know, we don't strictly not employ anyone who doesn't smoke, but we encourage our entire workforce to not smoke.
Yeah.
And managers and directors cannot smoke. That's simple, the way it goes. So, you know, again, this is like sort of prevention in action, but the shocker, the numbers may not necessarily immediately mean something to the viewers, but the The cost of dementia, if they do nothing within the next 15 or so years for China, will be $1.5 trillion, which is about half of our entire GDP.
Yeah.
So it's an absolute ticking time bomb. I mean, it is here too. But the thing is, we will not be having this same conversation in 10 years' time because it'll be an absolute mess. With a older population, that the cost of dementia is just going to, just bankrupt everything. So it's fascinating to see what China, will or won't do, because they obviously have more sort of, social control. And one thing I found a while ago, because I remember GSK, the drug company, went into China with many, many, many millions of dollars of bribe money, in effect, to get into the chain of the health minister and the this and that, whatever, got rumbled and busted and fined many, many, many millions. So I don't know if this is true, but to a large extent, China may be not under the control of the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, that would...
I know there are lots of bad things, things... but they, they're fascinating, piece of sort of economic demographic, and with the ability potentially to sort of make a lifestyle that could prevent dementia, and they're going to have to do it one way or another.
Yeah. Well, I will be looking at that or watching that with great interest because, like you say, it's fascinating, and well done you for pushing into China as well. And, it just remains to say that there's a line in your book where you just say, just read this book, which is Upgrade Your Brain by Patrick Colford, and do the cognitive function test. And then you'll know what you need to do to improve your chances. So I think we'll leave it there. If everybody just reads the book, it is full of the most... of the best information actually out there about diet, about cognitive function, about what, where we might be going wrong in our current diets, where we might be going wrong in our habits. We didn't talk about exercise very much, but exercise is so important as well. Read the books. And thank you so much for writing the book and for all the work that you're doing. Do you have one last word for everybody out there who might want to just make sure that they don't go down the cognitive dysfunction route?
Well, I think you're totally right. If you read the book, you will go, by the end of it, you'll go, wow.
Yeah.
So easy to prevent this thing. And if you do the test, foodforthebrain.org, alongside the book, it really sort of rams it home. So you're absolutely right. If everyone just did those two actions, you sort of can't resist but take something on. And you don't have to do it all. You may have a few bad habits here and there, but what happens is, I mean, I have to say my dear friend Dennis, who's been completely resistant to this for years, is a fantastic fellow, but every time I've seen him, literally for the last 8 years, I do the test. And I told him again, and he said he would again. And then I just said, I'm not going to say it ever again. And I rang him up and said, have you done this? He said, yes. I said, how was it? He said, it's really interesting,
yeah.
Provocative. It's kind of woken me up. And I rang him up this weekend and I said, what's happening? He said, well, actually, I've quit cigarettes. And he was basically a caffeine and cigarette, lovely fellow, very spiritual, et cetera, but that generation just didn't take it on board. And just the process of doing this has just created a shift, which has led him to make behavior changes. And if you do become a friend of the charity, you get into this sort of slipstream of what's called cognition, where you get fed stuff, you keep being fed things specifically for you. So, there is only one action: read the book, take the test. The rest will follow. It just will. You will now be in that group of people who have dementia-proofed their diet and lifestyle. Why not?
Well, thank you. Yeah, why not? Certainly has worked for me. And, I haven't probably done everything that I should be doing, but certainly a lot more than I was doing before. So, I'm very happy that I took the test. I would have resisted it too, but I took it because I was going to be speaking to you and I needed to know what the test was all about, but I'm glad I did. So, Patrick, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I think you're doing fantastic work, and here's to everybody improving their cognitive function. Thanks so much.
All the best. Thanks.
Great to have Patrick back on the show there. Now, I had a bit of a surprise when I redid the test, as my risk was slightly higher than before. But, you know, that's easily explained because I had been taking a glutathione supplement, which is a really good antioxidant, when I first did the test, and I had stopped recently. So you can be sure that I'll get back on the glutathione ASAP now that I've seen the test result. I'm still in the low risk category, but there's no need for me to get complacent, is there? I do recommend the test. Once again, you'll find it at foodforthebrain.org. It's very thorough, and combined with the book, it's really helpful if you're looking to diminish your risk of Alzheimer's or vascular dementia. And on that note, we're at the end of the show. I hope that you've been encouraged to take more responsibility for your brain health, just as I have. You can find out more about me and my work at thepracticalalchemist.uk. And while you're there, do subscribe to my newsletter and look me up on social media, including my YouTube channel, Alternatively Speaking. For now, though, thank you for listening. I hope you'll join me again here on UK Health Radio for more great guests and more information on how we can transform our well-being naturally. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.